First of all, I want to say thanks for the opportunity to come and speak. When Mike called me and asked me if I'd give his presentation, I obviously said yes, and we talked about it for a while. And then when I got off the phone, I had to take off my socks and my shoes so I could count how many years it's been since I actually have worked on potassium. It's been a number of years. I did my PhD dissertation at the University of Arkansas under Derek Oosterhaus, who's coming up next. And my dissertation focused on some of the physiological aspects of potassium nutrition in cotton. So that's what I'm going to present to you today is the work that we did when I was a graduate student at the University of Arkansas. So while I guess this data may be somewhat dated, it must still be some current information because, you know, I'm here. And you know, I don't know, this is an area that I think simply because of there's fewer and fewer people in academia, period, in agriculture, so there probably are fewer and fewer people working on potassium nutrition. But anyway, this is a two-part presentation. The first part, we're going to focus on some physiological changes associated with potassium deficiency in cotton. The second part, I'm going to focus more on photosynthesis and some of the what we found there. We all know that in-season potassium fertility recommendations are based on diagnostic tissue tests. More commonly, that's PDL tests. We know also that these recommendations are not always reliable for various reasons. One of the things we found out in my dissertation was due to partitioning of potassium in the plant, which I'm not going to cover today. But another reason is we're not exactly sure what that critical PDLK concentration is. We know that PDLK concentrations are correlated with yield, but at that time we were interested in studies to determine what PDL potassium concentration resulted in decreased physiological processes. And certainly when you get to that point, you know you're going to be impacting dry mass accumulation and ultimately yield. And we were hoping at that time where the intention was that this data would result in more accurate potassium fertility recommendations. Now this is where you start to see that these data are dated. Delpine 20 is a variety. I'm sure we all grew a lot of that in the cotton belt this year, but it's an early maturing variety, it was a good variety in its day. This slide on materials and methods took me probably about 6 to 8 months to really fine tune. One of the things I learned in my dissertation is if you're going to study deficiency, the development of any deficiency symptom, first of all, you need that symptom to develop, okay? And you need it to develop over a period of time because you want to study these changes associated with the development of this deficiency. And so obviously, you know, if we're studying nitrogen, potassium, whatever, when the plant is fully in a deficient state and has a bunch of brown leaves, you know what the result or the answer is going to be. So I tried to develop a protocol and actually published this as part of my dissertation on how you can set up a study to study the development of a potassium deficiency in cotton. So for this study, we grew our cotton in sand field pots, and we gave them full nutrients, Hoagland's nutrient solution, until 14 days after planting. And then we mixed up a different Hoagland solution that was devoid of any potassium, and we let that run. And it took a period of several weeks for that deficiency symptom to fully develop. We all know that cotton is a luxury consumer of potassium. So you can't just feed the plant potassium one day and the next day expect a deficiency symptom to show up. So it took me a while to really fine-tune this protocol. And once I got it going, I ran a lot of studies through the growth chamber and got some good data. So anyway, these studies, as I said, were conducted in the growth chamber. I spent a lot of Derek's money maintaining those growth chambers, keeping the lights up, temperature, and all that. So anyway, that was our protocol. We took measurements. It's 13 days after treatment establishment, and we took them for a period of several weeks. And the third mainstem leaf from the top at this time was 7 days old, and that was the leaf that we more or less focused on for all of our data collection. These are the measurements that we took: instantaneous leaf photosynthesis, ATP, chlorophyll, non-structural carbohydrates. At the end of all of it, we figured, well, we'll take a dry mass measurement as well, and then we did tissue K. This presentation, these slides were developed a few years ago. It's been about 12 years since I graduated from the University of Arkansas, so I had to take socks and shoes off both feet to get to that number. But anyway, have you ever seen a presentation where they tried to scan in 35 millimeter slides. Anyway, this is some of our data. So a lot of these slides are scanned in, and certainly you can tell it. But this slide shows you what the tissue K concentrations were in the various tissues as a function of days after treatment establishment in our two treatments. And I'm not sure why I didn't have any mean separation information on some of these slides. I think back again, that was a few years ago, but I think the software we had at that time, if I remember right, it was kind of hard to edit these slides once you got them going. But anyway, I apologize for no mean separation information on these slides, but there is some on some of these slides. But you can see that tissue K obviously dropped in all of the tissues that we monitored from the first sampling date. And we have a 100K, which is essentially we kept full-strength Hoagland solution, and then our 0K is our treatment where we removed the potassium in the Hoagland solution. So you can see again that as with time, the tissue K also decreased. Do we have a pointer?
Use the mouse.
Okay. All right. One thing I would like to point out is we are monitoring, you know, and it's standard procedure to monitor PDOK, and you can see here that PDOK, even though it started off low, it continued to drop throughout the development of this deficiency symptom. Or as you can see that leaf K also dropped, but relatively, on a relative scale, it didn't drop to the extent that PDOK did. And that was one of the questions we had at that time, is should we be sampling leaves or petioles? This is a slide illustrating leaf photosynthesis as a function of the various days after treatment. And you can see in our 100K treatment, leaf photosynthetic rates increased throughout this period, which is good because, you know, again, this leaf was about 7 days old when we first started, and we know that at that time the leaf is still young and it hasn't reached its peak necessarily from a photosynthesis standpoint, and it continued to increase the next time, which is what we'd expect to see. Again, you would expect photosynthetic rates to increase in a leaf that was growing, that was aging up to about 21 days. We also saw obviously that leaf photosynthetic rates the second 2 days obviously were much lower. The third time that we took these measurements, leaf photosynthetic rates were essentially zero. And I'll provide some. And again, that was at a leaf K concentration that was less than 1%. Leaf ATP. One of the things that was interesting about this is that in a 0K treatment, leaf ATP trended upward as the deficiency became more severe, and leaf ATP trended downward in the full K treatment throughout time. And you would expect this to be the opposite on first observation, because if photosynthetic rates are higher, you know, we know that the light reactions are part of the photosynthetic apparatus, and they're responsible for the production of energy and reducing power, so you would expect that leaf ATP would increase with potassium and decrease with no potassium. But that leaf ATP, as we all know, is used to produce reduced carbon in the dark reactions. And so that what we're guessing is we kind of had a feedback mechanism going on. Since that ATP essentially wasn't being utilized as what we felt like was happening, when the potassium deficiency developed, so it was basically accumulating in the plant. We felt like it was decreasing with time in the 100K treatment because, you know, photosynthetic rates were high, which also meant carbon reduction was also high. Respiration rates were probably also high, so it was keeping that pool of ATP somewhat depleted. When we looked at leaf chlorophyll, as the deficiency symptom developed, obviously chlorophyll A, B, total chlorophyll all reduced with the development of that potassium deficiency, which again you would expect that because the leaf is yellowing. Our ratio appeared to stay somewhat consistent. When we look at soluble sugars in the leaf, pretty much every time we took leaf discs in the morning and in the evening and looked at all the various sugars, and what we found is in the 0K treatments, either in the AM or PM, we saw accumulation of sugars, of hexoses and sucrose, relative to the full potassium treatment. And again, if photosynthetic rates are declining as a function of potassium deficiency, plant respiration rates probably also decline as well. We also know that potassium is involved in the translocation of carbohydrates, sucrose in particular. So, you know, felt like probably what's the mechanism behind this is A, these sucroses in particular aren't being translocated out of the leaf, and B, they're not being utilized in respiration because that process has probably been reduced as well. This is another slide where we just look at starch and then our total carbohydrates, and it essentially tells you the same thing. Sugars were accumulating in the leaf as a function of reduced potassium. We also found what we would hopefully see in starch in a leaf that was healthy. You would see starch accumulate in that leaf later in the day relative to the early to the morning sample, whereas we didn't have any starch in the leaf. The evening sample, we did have starch in the leaf in a healthy leaf. And again, that was an indication to me, at least, that we had a decent data set, because what we would expect in terms of starch accumulation under a normal situation, we actually saw. Oops. We also did some electron microscopy there, and I like to ask my students in class, "What's this?" You know, after we've had a chance to study this in textbook, I'll say, "What's this?" And I get about the same response, you know, nobody. So anyway, this is a leaf chloroplast. Obviously, we can see well-defined grana, and we can see, obviously, a few starch granules in this chloroplast. And this is a morning section that we took, okay, in the full K treatment. Everything looks good. This is a chloroplast in the treatment where we had a deficiency symptom. Again, you can see that big old starch granule right there in the middle. The plant, since it's not utilizing sucrose or reduced carbohydrates and not able to transport them, it's storing what it does have in the form of starch in the leaf. Also, the grana are not well defined, and they're all pushed out here to the edges of this chloroplast. And also, you can see the whatever is in the cytoplasm is not taking up the stain as well as it is in the full K treatment. Our plant growth analysis at the end of all this, some of this you would expect. This is root dry weight and stem dry weight. Obviously, if carbon uptake and respiration are reduced as a result of a deficiency symptom, you would expect dry weights to be lower, which they were. We look at specific leaf weights as well. We had leaf areas and leaf weights, so we just calculate specific leaf weights. They didn't appear to change. And also main stem node number didn't appear to change. So I guess you could say maybe cell division was going along like it normally does, but carbon accumulation or dry weight accumulation was being reduced. So what we concluded from this study was that differences in tissue K did not affect physiology at that first sampling date. Luxury storage, and we felt like that was due to luxury storage and remobilization. When you give a cotton plant all the potassium you can, it's going to take it up, and it's going to store it, and then as you want to study deficiency symptom, you may have to wait a little while. So we got our protocol worked out, and we had a good slow development of a potassium situation. Felt like that critical leaf potassium level, based on our data, was less than 1%, and the PDO was, less than 1% as well. got 6 more minutes, so I'm going to try to maybe pick this up just a little bit. The second study is we took a more detailed look at the effects of potassium deficiency on photosynthesis, and also we want to look at carbon isotope discrimination. We know that photosynthesis requires the simultaneous inward flux of CO2 from outside the leaf and its fixation of organic compounds in the leaf. So we're taking CO2 up. We're using energy from light reactions, and then in dark reactions, we're making carbohydrates. This is another basic slide from Crop Physiology 101. We see here a stomate, and CA is ambient CO2 concentration. CI is intercellular CO2 concentration. We have a mesophyll cell here with a greatly enlarged chloroplast for reference. So again, CO2 moved from CA to CI across a few membranes, some cytosol into the site of fixation in a normal situation. Now, CI represents a balance between the rates of inward CO2 flux, which is controlled by stomatal conductance, and CO2 assimilation, which is controlled by the light and dark reactions. Different CO2 diffusion limitations to photosynthesis can be evaluated by analyzing the supply function, which is the stomatal component, or the demand function, which is the non-stemol component. Okay, we're bringing CO2 into this plant or into this leaf. Is it being utilized by that leaf in the process of reduced carbohydrates? So this ratio of intercellular to ambient CO2 concentration can result in a change in the 13C composition of a plant sample relative to the 12C composition or C12 composition. You know, we know that Rubisco discriminates against this heavier isotope of carbon. We also know that in certain situations that ability to discriminate begins to deteriorate, especially under a water stress situation. We were wondering if it would also deteriorate during the development of a potassium deficiency symptom, and would this ratio change? So changes that occur in the photosynthetic apparatus and resulting carbon isotope composition during the development of a potassium deficiency symptom really hadn't been studied that much in cotton at that time, so we felt like it'd be a good thing to look at. And obviously, you know, from a more basic standpoint, all these limitations to photosynthesis due to stemol limitations or mesophyll limitations or some combination thereof. So again, had our same protocol, Dedapine 20, which as we know is a real common variety these days, full nutrient solution until 14 days, and then we withdrew the nutrient solution with potassium, and then we took our measurements again at the same time period. It took me a while to get this protocol down, but once I got it, I was really going because that graduation date was getting closer and closer. And Angela said something about being pregnant, and so anyway, you'd be amazed at how inspired you can become when something like that happens. This is just a photograph of the general setup. We actually did all this in the greenhouse, but this is just kind of one of those pose shots. We had a ADC, I believe is what it was, photosynthesis system. It's an open system. We had a light source on this, so we can maintain light at a constant level. And then one of the big benefits of these systems is we can change CO2 concentrations and construct what's known as an ACI curve, which I'll show you here. After we took all of our data, these leaves, we took our data, we removed from the plant, we determined their potassium concentration, and then determined their stable isotope ratio. Again, here's the leaf K concentrations. I've got some mean separations here, so I don't know what the deal was, but you can see in our plus K treatments, our potassium levels were very high, and then in our no K, even at 13 days, it was less than 1%, and then just continued to decline after that as time progressed. This is what that leaf looked like at 13 days. This is 9. This is less than 1%. Okay, so that's what it looked like at 13 days. So no, basically to me, no visual symptoms at that time. This is what it looked like the next time that we took our measurements. You can see some intervenal chlorosis beginning to develop here, and this is what the leaf looked like the third time. So again, you can see intervenal chlorosis, and you can also see some necrotic areas in this leaf. Again, here's our cuvette. I clamped this on here for the purposes of just taking this photograph. And I had a standard procedure for where I was actually going to take my measurement on that leaf. You know, this cuvette, if I remember right, was like the size of the chamber was something like a cubic centimeter or something. So obviously you're not taking a measurement of that entire leaf. You're taking a measurement of one place on that leaf. And you can also tell, at least early on, that the first place you see deficiency symptoms will be a marginal, a little around the leaf margins. So we took our sample somewhere in a standardized place. This was leaf photosynthetic rates. I'm running out of time here. Again, you can see at the last 2 days, especially, leaf photosynthetic rates were very low compared to the full K treatment. When we look at our ACI curves, this was our 13 days after treatment establishment ACI curves. You can see that there are no differences here. This leaf was at right at under 1% K, and you can see these arrows represent photosynthetic rates at ambient CO2 concentrations. You can see they're pretty much on top of each other. You can also see our CO2 compensation point was pretty much the same between the two, and certainly our slopes were identical as well. This was the next day. We're down to less than 0.9% K. You can see our photosynthetic rates at ambient CO2 are different, much lower in the deficient leaf, and also our compensation points were higher in the leaf where we had reduced K, and also our slopes are different as well. The third time, even more dramatic, our photosynthetic rate at ambient CO2 concentration was pretty much at the CO2 compensation point on this particular day. So you can, you know, basically what it means when you see a deficiency symptom, then that leaf is pretty much, you know, there's no carbon gain, net carbon gain in that leaf. Farquhar and Sharkey several years ago proposed a method of determining relative stomal limitation, which they define as the percent reduction in photosynthesis below the rate which would occur if stomal conductance were not limiting. And we calculated all that. And again, we can see in our NOK treatment, those numbers just jumped way up these last 2 days in particular. Also, if an increase in relative stomal limitation is the dominant cause of a reduction in net photosynthesis, then CI must decrease, okay? Your supply side is being clamped off, so CI must decrease. If an increase in limitations within the mesophyll dominates, then reduction in photosynthesis is an increase in CI is expected. So your demand side, if it decreases, then you would expect an increase in intercellular CO2 concentration. This is our intercellular CO2 concentrations. And again, you can see, I don't have any statistics, all the statistics are on my dissertation, but anyway, the last 2 days, CI really did, let's see here, it's been a while, it increased, I may need to skip this slide because I don't know how to explain it, but it looks like it may have gone down here and up here, and anyway, one of those, that's why I didn't put any mean separation data on this slide, but anyway, maybe this is one of those slides that Max Stewart gave me a hard time about in my defense. I don't really remember. But anyway, it appeared to change. We'll go on. I'm out of time anyway. We looked at instantaneous intercellular ambient CO2. Again, we saw this ratio jump way up, which again is an indication that our intercellular CO2 concentration is increasing. And we're limited on the demand side, or our mesophyll resistances are increasing. Integrated, I looked at this slide. I didn't want to go back to the original methodology paper. I can't remember how we measured integrated intercellular and ambient CO2 concentration, but it must have been right because they let me graduate. And here are the data. You can see again that they decreased with time as the potassium deficiency developed. Finally, carbon isotopic composition. We can see that decreased again those last 2 days, and this is an indication again that our ability of Rubisco to discriminate against the heavier carbon isotope was being reduced. And so anyway, the conclusions we drew from this study, certainly leaf potassium decreased, photosynthesis decreased in response to potassium deficiency, relative stomal limitations increased, and instantaneous CI increased after 13 days. Basically, I think the take-home message from this study was, is when we had a mild deficiency symptom, stomal limitations were the greatest limitation to photosynthesis. And you would expect that because we know potassium is very much involved in stomal movements. But as that deficiency continued to develop, then it became a problem with mesophyll limitations, which you would also kind of expect, because if you've got necrotic areas on the leaf, you can pretty much count on reduced photosynthetic rates and respiration and whatnot. So that, I guess, I'm sorry, Mike, I'll sit down. I want a few minutes.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Great, thanks.